Hi, and welcome to Recovery Internet Radio, brought to you live and direct from Straight Stuff Studios. Thanks for joining us this Sunday. We're happy that you found us. I'm going to go ahead and introduce our host this week and every week, Mr. Rick Atwater.
Oh, hi, everybody. I'm glad you could join us tonight, and I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy that you are listening. Welcome again to Recovery Internet Radio and our show, Straight Stuff on Addictions. Our tag tonight is the rhythms of life, and there's a specific reason why we're using that tag, which I'll get to in a minute, but thanks for joining us tonight where we are every Sunday night at 8 o'clock, and thanks to our engineer, Chris. You can tweet us at Rick Atwater if you have questions or comments. And please remember to check out recoveryinternetradio.com. That's
recoveryinternetradio.com.
We got a little musical there, didn't we?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
First time.
For all our archive shows and recovery resources. Let me just tell you a little bit about our guest tonight, Steve Ferroni. Steve is a drummer and a fairly well-known drummer. He's currently working with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. He has lived what I would call a couple lives. He has been an entertainer from a very early age. He opened for The Who before anybody knew who The Who was.
Ooh.
Wow, that's quite a sentence.
Clever.
He's been quite a sought-after drummer his whole career. He has done stints with bands as diverse as progressive jazz guys like Brian Auger and the Oblivion Express. He is, as I said, working with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and he has done his time with Eric Clapton, and I think he's pretty well known for being in a band called the Average White Band in the late 70s. Very well-known people. Steve's value, however, runs much deeper than drums or fame for being a drummer. He's made some pretty significant changes in his life in the early 90s, and those changes and their impact on his life today are the things we want to talk about in this week's segment. Steve got clean and sober at that time. So please join us this week in welcoming Mr. Steve Ferroni.
Hi, Steve, and welcome to tonight's show.
Where this whole thing started is you were doing a project in Chicago, and
that's right.
Then that's where, and then you knew Athena, who happens to be also a friend of mine. So that's how I ran into you, and you know got to know you just a little bit. What can you talk a little bit about what you were doing in Chicago?
It's a small world, but I wouldn't want to clean it.
So what,
yeah,
what were you up to in Chicago?
Well, Athena's been doing a record, and an old friend of mine, Sandy Toronto, has been producing her, and I got some pretty good players and stuff together there, and we just cut a record. We were there for about a week and cut two or three songs a day, and everything's sounding pretty good. I think she's going to have a very nice record.
Is that what you guys usually do? Two, three songs a day?
Yeah. Sometimes it goes a little faster. Sometimes it goes a little slower. It just depends on how people work. I mean, what we were doing is that we cut the track and we get the track, and then there would be repairs, little repairs, spot repairs here and there, and then additional guitars and stuff. So I'd spend a lot of time sort of sitting around waiting for the next track to start.
So, gotcha.
So,
yeah.
So get the drums and the bass pretty much there, and then and people have like make a little mistake in the chord change or something, or can play something a little bit better, and so they just touch that up. And so it's very rare that we get to play with a group of musicians in the room at the same time now.
Is that right? So that was a little bit of a rare event for you there.
Absolutely. My band is Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and we play everything live like that. You know, so that's how we make our records. And most records that I work on,
yeah,
go in and it's just me or me and a bass player maybe. You know, and put down the track that way.
Now, these guys that you were with in the project in Chicago, this was a bit of a rare. These were guys that you've worked with in the past, or these, because these were all like guys from all over the place that sort of got. It was almost like a reunion type of thing for you guys.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've worked with Darryl Jones. I've worked with Darryl Jones. We play a lot together in Los Angeles. We play with the guitarist Mendoznoy from New York, and I see Darryl around on recording sessions and stuff with him. But Hamish Stewart, we used to play together in Average White Band.
Yeah.
Back in the day, and I haven't played with him in years. I mean, I've seen him. We hang out, and when I go, but we haven't really worked together in the longest time. And it's really nice to sit down and play with him again after all this time.
Now I wonder how many people in the listening audience that we have are going to know who the Average White Band was. It so happens I do, but because I know what your birthday is, and mine's 1 year prior.
Ah, all right. Yeah.
So, but so
you're a Taurus too.
Yeah. But I happen to know. Yeah. So, but I happen to know the Average White Band. But yeah. You know, and Hamish was, and I actually got to talk to him when I was there a little bit, because it was really a treat to meet him when I was in the studio. What was the name of the studio, by the way? What is it? The studio? Sandy's Place.
Scandal.
Scandalous. Yeah, Scandalous Studios. I love that name.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, Average White Band. So, and that was in the 70s, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
I met Sandy back in those days, too.
He wasn't in that band, was he?
No, he was in a band called Night Flight. And,
okay.
He was managed by Doc McGee, who's a good friend of mine, and he asked me to go down there and play with the band. So, down in Florida.
Yeah. Average White Band. So, yeah, how long did you play with them?
Average White Band, I'd say around 10 years.
Is that a pretty average lifespan for a drummer?
I played with a few bands long periods of time. I mean, I was with Eric Clapton for about I think maybe 8 or 9 years, something like that.
I've been
with Tom Petty for 20 years.
Really?
So But I mean, I have long-term relationships with people that I've worked with over the years that I've done records with. I recently did a record with Ziggy Marley, and I did a record with him maybe a decade ago, and I knew his father,
mm-hmm.
and I know him. And on this session, he introduced me to his kids, so I know three generations of Marleys. So.
that's something that everybody can't say. I don't think everybody can say that. But you know, I mean, I guess you know, those of us that are not don't know a lot about the music business think it's a lot different. But really, you get to know the people you work with. You work with them for a long time. You get to know a lot of people in the industry. You get to be friends.
Absolutely.
And I guess that's the way it works, no matter what. Are you smoking your cigar?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, because I noticed you were smoking when we were taking a break at the studio, and you know.
That's what I like to do when I relax and I kick back.
They won't let you smoke it in the studio,
huh? Actually, I'm sitting in one of my favorite places, which is my backyard, looking at my backyard and the grass and the trees, and it's very quiet, and I'm just sitting there smoking a cigar. It's one of my favorite things to do. Of course, all that's going to be shattered in the next few hours when my girlfriend arrives from Russia.
From Russia?
Yeah. I have a girlfriend. I have a habit of long-distance relationships. And stuff. So I picked one just about as far away as I could get this time. She lives in St. Petersburg.
She lives in St. Petersburg. Yeah. That's pretty far. I'm not going to.
Yeah,
I don't think I'm going to ask you a lot of questions about that, Steve.
It's a 12-hour difference.
Yeah. Isn't it? And so she's.
I go to bed. She's getting up. She goes to bed. I'm getting up.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's one way to. Is that a way you sustain relationships?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, relationships can be hard, you know, I guess they're hard for everybody. They're particularly rough on musicians because of traveling and I guess sometimes temptation, you know, in my case. You know,
yeah.
But things have a way of sort of smoothing out over the years. I know your program's about recovery, especially since I took that out of my life, and my life's got a lot smoother.
Yeah. Well, I bet it has. Yeah. I bet it has. And maybe that's a good segue into talking a little bit more about that. Can we talk a little bit? I know you mentioned you were born in Brighton.
Yes, correct. Yeah, that was the town with the most pubs per capita of any town in England. Every street corner had a pub. You could actually find your way around town by giving the names of pubs.
No kidding. Now,
yeah.
Go
down to the bush, you turn left, you turn right, and you go to the King's Head. You know.
that's the way it works. Now see,
yeah.
In you know, I'm told that in Texas they measure distance by beers. You know, like so.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to go from Dallas to Houston, you know, that's a 3-beer drive or something like that. But that's
Well, it's the same thing. Whoa, they're playing pretty low. Where is he? Yeah. It's the same sort of deal in Brighton. It's the same sort of deal with the pubs. You know.
So drinking is
every corner. Literally every corner is a pub.
And it's part of the. It's just part of the culture. It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And that's the way.
Well, the way it was. A lot of them have closed down now.
Why is that?
I'm not really sure whether it's whether the breweries work differently or a lot of the pubs. One of the pubs on my corner is now like a little sandwich and coffee place to go in. My mother during the war was walking. She was out. She went out to the shops shopping, and she was coming back, and she was walking past this park called the Level in Brighton that had a big sort of. It was a circular park with big trees all around the outside, and the park was in the middle. And underneath the trees, they had stashed like tanks and. Trucks and stuff ready to, because they thought Brighton was going to be one of the places that if Germany was going to invade England, they would come in through Brighton.
Really?
And so they had all this stuff like stashed underneath these trees, and my mother was walking past that. She had to walk past that to get to her house, and a German fighter plane came in low over the channel and popped up without alerting the radar. So they had there were two warnings. You always hear the sirens, and back in those days, when they were overhead, they have a thing called the pits, which would go off, and they would go pip 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 pip, which meant they were directly overhead, and the pits went off. There wasn't even any siren. The pits went off, and this guy came down and decided to have a go at these trees and see if there was anything underneath there. And my mother was just has happened to be walking across, and so it was.
Did he shoot it up?
Yeah. And my mum like fell down to the ground, and I guess you know the cannon shells were sort of exploding all around her, and he made his pass, and then everybody ran out of this pub and grabbed my mum and dragged her into this pub, and that pub is now a recovery house.
Well,
and I made a little trip there.
Yeah.
I made a little trip there one day.
Oh, did you now?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I told him the story. I said, you know, my mum, my mum who hid out in this pub once. Yeah.
Recovery yeah. in a lot of different ways. You know. In a lot of different ways. Were you from? Was your family entertainment people or were?
No.
No.
I come from a very working class, middle class, lower middle class family, would be considered, I suppose. My grandfather was a milkman. My mother was a factory worker. My grandmother was a stay-at-home grandmother.
Yeah.
She looked after people, basically.
Yeah, my grandfather was a milkman, too, actually.
Oh, really?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was.
Well, my grandfather was the alcoholic in my family. I came to find out that he was an untreated alcoholic.
Well, mine was too. Actually, he used to pick up the money on Friday and then go out drinking. Yeah. And one day he was driving across a river that was frozen, he thought.
Yeah.
And he went in the river and drowned.
Well, my grandfather had a slightly different story. At the end of my street, there was a brewery, and he used to work in the brewery, and he would get drunk for free every day, you know, and he would come back home, and he's just this drunk, and of course, he went from being a jolly drunk to a miserable drunk, and came back home at one point, and gotten into an altercation with my grandmother, and decided to raise his hand to my grandmother, and my grandmother told my mother to go up the street, and fetch Uncle Ted. And Uncle Ted was Teddy Harmon, and he was a boxing champion. Uncle Ted came down and literally beat the poo out of my grandfather.
Oh, and by the way, this is internet radio, no FCC regulations, so if you want to use...
Okay, well, beat the shit out of my grandfather. Literally beat the shit. My dad beat him so bad he shit his pants. And then my grandfather quit working at the brewery and became a milkman, which was like, you know, going the other end. But he was the most miserable man I ever met in my life. He was an alcoholic that stopped drinking but didn't have any recovery.
The worst of all possible worlds, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, no relief from the nonsense in the head.
So he was unhappy about everything. He didn't really like anything. As a matter of fact, he'd still have a beer once in a while, but you know, he could never drink actually the one time my uncle took him out for a drink to celebrate something, maybe his birthday or something, he got plastered and he walked through a plate glass window. and this was like 80 years old. Yeah.
So he just couldn't, he just was one of those guys that just wasn't going to be able to drink without consequences, I guess, huh?
No. He died when he was 93, but like I say, he wasn't a very happy man. You know?
Yeah.
I think the thing for me is that I hear people talking about, like, well, you know, if I drink, I'm going to die. I can't drink anymore because I'm going to die. It's not really so much the dying. We're all going to die.
Yeah.
That's not a problem. I think the problem is how you live up until the point of dying, and that can be a nightmare. You know, I know I was in one myself.
Yeah. And so do you think that that's, as far as you know, common with people that have alcoholism, that just stopping drinking is
I don't think it's enough. I don't believe it's enough. I think there are people that can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people that are of the alcoholic disposition, if you're a heavy drinker and you stop, you might just get an idea about what's going on and stop drinking and it doesn't affect you. I've seen that happen.
Yeah,
I've seen it happen in families where one person really needs to go to a program, and then other people, counselling or therapy or, you know, something that would stabilise them mentally.
Right.
And other people can just stop and just walk away, just say, I'm not going to drink anymore. It doesn't affect them.
Right.
So even heavy drinkers, people who even got into trouble, I've seen people, you know, with DWIs they go to therapy, they go to program, or they get into a program and they go and they learn stuff about it, and then they say, oh, okay, well, I'm not going to do that anymore, and they don't.
Yeah.
And they live happy, normal lives. But alcoholics really, really need to watch a lot of their thinking, more so than their drinking, I believe.
Right. Yeah. So alcoholism is not just the drinking; it's the thinking.
Well, I know my thinking has been 20 years now, and I haven't had a drink, and still my thinking can sometimes get a little crazy. But I have a program. When my thinking starts to get crazy, I have things that I can do. I have a certain people that I call and that help me to get my head on straight. And when I get my head on straight, I usually say, "What was I thinking?" Yeah.
You were thinking maybe a different part of your body, but we, again, this is internet radio, we can say what we mean. But can I jump back to, I know I just got to say this because I know people would be interested. You were playing your drums when you were 12 years old, and I know I made the mistake of saying originally that you were playing with The Who. You corrected me and said you were opening for The Who.
Yeah, I played in a band that opened for the Who,
At age 12. And then I said, would that be called a prodigy? You know what I'm saying? Is that a musical prodigy? I mean, that's pretty young to be.
Well, I as soon as I could walk my, I was a little kid sitting in a high chair being fed, and we had a radio back then. There was no TV, So there would be some music on the radio, and I would start banging my spoon on the high chair in time to the music. And so my grandmother and my mother said, we've got to do something with this kid. So they decided to send me to tap dancing school, and I was a very, very good tap dancer.
No kidding.
And, You don't do it, do you? Well, not anymore. With I got this bum knee at the moment. I can't really tap dance. Yeah. I can probably do it on one foot.
I'd like to see that.
I was pretty good tap dancer. I won some festivals and some medals and some cups and stuff. And it was like proper classes. Where you take classes and you could take an exam to move up into a more difficult level.
Mm-hmm. And so you moved up through that, and that's all about the rhythm.
I moved up rapidly through that. Yeah. But then, I got a job. I got a job in a children's chorus in a summer show with a very well-known sort of TV personality guy in England, a guy named Max Bygraves at the time. I went and auditioned and got into this children's chorus, and I was out there on the stage doing my thing one night, and I looked down into the orchestra pit and I saw the drummer, and I saw how he was playing the drums, and I thought, oh, I wonder if I can do that, move my hands that way, learn how to use my hands, and then started to add feet, and you could hear what the bass drum was doing. I could hear rhythm,
mm-hmm.
because I'd hear syncopation because I've been dancing for a long time. So that's how I sort of drifted into drums. Broke my parents' heart when I decided that I was going to stop tap dancing and be a drummer.
Really? They wanted you to stay. They wanted you to be a tap dancer.
Yeah. My grandmother wanted me to be Fred Astaire. No. Thank God she didn't want me to be Ginger Rogers.
Yeah, thank God. Yeah. What would have happened? How do they feel about it now? It seems like you've been reasonably successful in your drumming career.
Oh, right now they don't feel too much because they're all dead. My grandmother and my mother, they came to concerts and they loved to see me out there on the stage. It's a thrill for them.
Oh, that's great. Well, can you take us, through a little bit through your musical career? You started to drum there back when you were 12, and then what happened?
Well, I started to drum when I was 12. I went to school about around 13, because school leaving age in England was 15 at that point. You could leave, or you could stay on for an extra year and get what they call a Brighton School Certificate, which I would imagine you would call a high school diploma. And the schools for my class of people, you could become either a train driver or a labor, a plumber or electrician, tradesman.
Yeah.
Or if you stayed on that extra year, then you would go into civil service or into the banks, work for banks or something. Yeah.
And that's basically what your choices were at that point?
Yeah, and college, in college never even came into it. I was like, who the hell are these people going to college? My grandmother was a pretty good artist. She could draw.
Yeah.
When she was young, they wanted to put the teachers at her school spotted her talent, wanted to put her into art school. And her parents said, no, well, we don't want them doing that nonsense. She needs to get a job,
Yeah.
So she never got to pursue it. So she kind of like latched onto me when she saw that I had a talent. She decided like that.
She wanted you to succeed there. So did you did you go on or did you stop at 15?
I stopped at 15. Stopped at 15 because they around 13 or 14 they started to ask you what you wanted to do when you left school.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I want to play the drums. And they said, well, you can't do that. It's not a real job.
Yeah.
And I said, well, Ringo Starr does it. And they said, well, that's Ringo Starr. And I said, well, I can do what he does.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can do that. So then they started to, like, you know, get a little bit derogatory with me and say, you know, start calling me Ringo. Hey, Ringo. You know, and it was like, oh, okay. You want to play that?
Yeah.
So I used to box for the school. I used to play football or soccer, as they call it in America.
Yeah. How do you pronounce it in American? Soccer?
Soccer. Soccer.
Yeah.
It's football.
It's football. Yeah. We've always had that wrong, though. So, but yeah.
Well, you know, you'll get it right eventually.
Eventually we'll get it.
America's getting it right eventually. That's why I became an American, to help you understand there's a difference between football and football.
And football and soccer. Yeah, well, I think we're doing pretty good. World Cup-wise, I mean, think about it. You know, we're up there.
Yeah, exactly. You're doing good. You're doing good in the playing department.
Yeah, we qualify.
Yeah.
So,
well, you should. You've got some amazing athletes in America. You've got some amazing athletic programs. So.
Some of them are British retreads, you know. But anyway, you know. So all right. So you were just doing the regular thing, but when you told
then
me
I stopped. I went on strike. I went on strike from studying at school. I went on strike from everything.
Yeah.
Except playing. And I started to play. I used to play with little kids like my age, about 12.
Yeah.
And then this band of big kids that were like 18 got stuck for a drummer, and there was a little kid that I used to play with.
Mm-hmm.
He had a real guitar, so we used to hang out around the music stores, you know.
Yeah.
And he would hang out around the bigger kids, and he overheard their conversation, and he said, "Well, listen, I know this kid that can play the drums, you know." And they said, well, who is he? And they said, well, it's this guy Steve. You know?
Yeah.
And they said, well, why don't you go get him, tell him to be at this place? You know, we didn't have telephones or anything in those days. Huh?
Tell him
to be at this place, you know.
Did you have a nickname?
No. Well, I had a number of nicknames at school.
Would you like
they
to
called me Jungle. Like Jungle was a nickname. Chalky, they called me. It's always had something to do with the opposite of me. They go, well, Jungle, I guess, wasn't the opposite. But
derogatory, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it was all derogatory. You know, nothing to be taken personally.
That's the way nicknames go.
As a matter of fact, I'm still friends with a lot of those guys.
Are you really?
Very much so. Two of them came, Mickey and Tony Barnes. Tony Barnes and Mickey Moore came to see me and play at the Albert Hall a couple of years ago. And we hung out for a minute. It was great talking about old times.
Oh, I bet it was. Hey, just while I'm thinking about it, did you know Ringo?
I met Ringo. I don't know him very well. I've met him a few times. You know.
Yeah.
I've run into him a few times. He's, you know, very nice fellow.
Yeah, I mean, it's.
I've met him with George. Actually, we played together once with George Harrison. That was a lot of fun. Yeah, he showed up at the rehearsal and. There was another drum kit on stage that Ray Cooper used to play, and he was sort of standing out in the front of the rehearsal. And I said, "Hey, you come up here and come up and play with us." You know?
Come up and play a little bit.
He came up, he came up and sat behind the drum kit and started playing with us, and it was great. You know, I got to play with two of the Beatles, half of the Beatles.
That's pretty good on the resume. Not bad.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this: you know, where along the way did you know the drugs and the alcohol stuff? Where did it start, and how, you know, like what? How old were you, and what was happening?
I think it started very, very sort of slowly. I mean, you know, I mean, I used to drink when I was, you know, I used to drink when I was underage in England. Everybody used to do that. Got drunk and threw up a few times.
What's the drinking age in London, in England?
18.
Oh, 18. Okay. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, there was no if you sort of looked old enough, you'd walk into a pub and you could say, like, the barman would say, "How old are you?" You say, 18. You say, "Okay, what do you want?" Yeah.
That was
the extent.
Yeah.
No, I mean, nobody had driver's licenses, nobody had ID or anything, you know. So.
They would just serve.
So that, yeah.
So
I did that. I did that for years, but nothing unusual. I went to Europe, and somebody gave me some pot while I was working on the American bases in Europe once, and I didn't really like it too much. It didn't really do too much for me. But that's not to say that I didn't smoke it again after.
Yeah.
Well, actually, tried it. It was like every time I've been drinking and somebody gave me some pot, I get sick. Yeah. And I'd have to sort of start over again with the drinking. I get really sick to it. It'd make me sick to my stomach. And I never ever said no. I never ever tried to. Never ever said no, no, no. I don't want any of that.
You didn't have much of an off switch then, did you?
No, no. Once I start drinking, it's on.
It's on. So like when you say you got to start over. So if you smoke some pot and you puked, then you got to start. Then you got to start drinking again.
I got to start drinking again then.
Because all that work to get the buzz and then
so,
it's all gone. So no.
That would me up. I have to start get drinking again.
Yeah.
If I could.
Yeah. Well, I would say that's a check mark on the list right there, my friend. But
yeah.
You know that's.
And then I worked with a band in France. I was 21 years old and I was working with this band. I'd actually met them in Italy and we moved to France.
Mm-hmm.
The trombone player in the band was kind of a guy, he was always depressed about something, you know, he was always that miserable about something, he wasn't very happy about stuff. And one day, he used to live in a caravan, and I went over to his caravan to visit, and he was all happy and bright, and I said, hey, what, are you in a good mood, what's up with you? And he says, man, this doctor gave me these pills, they're fantastic. I said, what are they? He said, it's called Cactagon. And I said, well, can I try one? Let me, you know, I wasn't particularly miserable, but he looked so happy, I wanted to join in, you know.
Yeah.
So he gave me one, and it was great. I could drink gallons. I wouldn't get sleepy or anything.
Yeah.
And I used to give lessons to a dentist, drum lessons, in Nice, and I asked him if he could get me any, and he said sure. And he just got me, like a whole boatload of them, you know. And so I had my own supply, and I don't know if it was so much of I had to have them, but they were there, you know. And if I wanted to use them, I'd use them. And then I came to America, and somebody introduced me to cocaine. Now that was a whole different story, because. You know, my mother had told me, you know, don't do drugs. I didn't consider that drugs, the Cactagon. I didn't consider that doing drugs. I didn't really think that was doing drugs.
Because the prescription, you got it from a dentist, so there you must be.
Yeah, I got it from a dentist. It was like something just in white, and I didn't end up like the people that I saw that were doing, like, you know, Purple Hearts and stuff, that would have like dried chewing gum around their mouths and stuff. I didn't end up like that. I wasn't out of it. I wasn't out of control. You know?
Got it. Yeah.
I went back to England and started working in England. And the thing in England was like, you know, to go over and have a cup of tea and a joint. And if I had a cup of tea and a joint, I would be okay. It was if I'd been drinking, I'd had a joint. And I got sick. You know? But So, you know, I did that. And then I came to America, and, you know, my mum was always like, you know, be careful of drugs. And so I'm not going to do any drugs, Mum. Don't worry about that. You know?
Was she more scared about you coming to America and the drugs? Or
no, she wasn't. She didn't even think about that by then. She kind of forgot about it by then. So then I came to America, and I was in Florida, and I was working with Brian Auger.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this guy like a party in one of the hotel rooms, and there was this guy, and he had this white powder, and he was making these lines with the white powder, and I kind of looked at this guy, and you know, it kind of scared me a little bit. I said, "What's that?" And he said, "It's cocaine." Now we had cocaine. My mum had always said to me when we went to the dentist, you know, when I was "Oh, I'm scared of going to the dentist." She said, "Don't worry, I'll give you some cocaine." You know,
they put it on your gums, right?
Yeah, and it would numb the gums. I think when they made the injections, they put it on the gums, and so you wouldn't feel anything.
Right.
So the guy said it's cocaine, you know, and he said, do you want some? And I said, no, I don't want any. He said, it's okay, it's not addictive.
Yeah.
And I said, all right. How do I do this? And then I did it, and I had a great night, and it had pretty much the same effect as what the Cactagon did. You know,
you really fought hard not to do it, didn't you? Yeah.
Huh?
You really fought hard not to do it, you know. Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, it didn't take much, yeah.
It's not addictive, okay.
it's not addictive, so it wasn't really a drug, you know. It wasn't, you know,
yeah.
It wasn't what my mom was talking about. You know.
Right, that was something else.
But,
did you keep...
Yeah.
And you're talking about...
It took a while to realize.
When you say Brian Auger, that's Brian Auger, Brian Auger Express, was that what the band was called?
Oblivion Express,
that's what it was called.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, how long did you play with them, by the way?
Oh, maybe 3 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
About 3 years.
Yeah.
And then I started to do sessions, and I got picked up by this a producer named what was his name? Kind of Chippin' Norton. Good. It'll come to me. I'm terrible at names. So I was working. I started to play with these studio musicians in London, a band called Gonzales.
Mm-hmm.
And we were playing in this club one night. Mike Vernon, that's his name.
That was the producer.
And Mike Vernon, this producer, came and said, "Look, I want to hire the band to go and play on a record with Freddie King."
Mm-hmm.
And so my first experience as a studio musician was playing on Freddie King's album Burglar.
Hmm.
And a pretty good album, pretty good stuff.
Yeah, pretty good stuff. What year was that?
Oh, I don't know. God, it must have been 73.
That was before Average White Band.
Oh, 73. Yeah. It'd be 73. Yeah, it was right before Average White Band.
Yeah.
And then Mike Vernon was producing a band called Bloodstone.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a hit, Natural High.
Mm-hmm.
And wanted me to work with them. They were doing a movie out here in Los Angeles, and I came out to work with them. And then I worked with them for a couple of months, about three or four months, and then Average White Band came to town, and I befriended them. I knew because I'd known Robbie, the drummer, the original drummer.
Uh-huh.
Known him for years. I'd met him when I first went to Italy when I was 17. And they came out here, and I went and hung out with them, saw them play at the Troubadour, and Robbie said, "Well, you know, last night the Troubadour was going to be a big party. You've got to come to that party." And I said, "Well, if I can, I've got to work on that day." And I think it was a Sunday, Saturday. And I finished. I couldn't get there to the party. And the next day, I got a phone call from a guy that worked for me, a guy named Terry Merchant. He called me up and he said, "Hey, Robbie's dead." And I said, "What? Dead drunk?" And he said, "No, he's dead."
Really?
So what happened? And he said, "Apparently, he did some heroin. He thought he was doing cocaine. And he did some heroin and he died." Now, what they didn't know about Robbie was that, you know, this everybody else who did it at that party got sick. It was heroin. It was cut with strychnine.
Oh, it was a bad bad dose.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And everybody got sick there at the party except for Robbie. The thing about Robbie was I'd known Robbie for years. He could drink. You wouldn't believe that guy could drink a bottle of scotch and switch to a bottle of vodka, and he would never get sick. He could mix wine, anything. And he'd never, ever get sick, but he would pass out.
Hmm.
And that's what happened. He passed out, and it stayed in his system, and it killed him.
Oh, jeez. That is sad.
Yeah.
That's sad. Was that the first person that you'd come across that had passed away from drugs and alcohol?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so...
So how did that affect
you? Well, he was a friend. He was my friend.
Yeah.
And I went around to see the band, and we drowned our sorrows. We sat around drinking, and talking about, the band had started to get some airplay. We'd pick up the pieces, and it's like, you guys can't stop now. Robbie wouldn't have wanted that, And so he said, "Well, can you come play with us a bit?" And I said, "Well, I can do little bits here and there." And I ended up sort of doing half of the gig, some of the gigs I couldn't make because I had to work with Bloodstone, and then when I couldn't make, Styx Hooper from the Crusaders would play. And
yeah.
And we'd go to see, me and Styx would go down, and they were auditioning drummers, and drummers were lined up around the block to play with Average White Band, and they'd sit there and they'd audition all these guys, and they'd thank you, and they'd get more and more depressed, and then we'd go and jam a little bit and cheer everybody up, and then they'd go back to the auditioning process. And it was during that time we went down to we went to play down at Long Beach, and went down there and played down there. And it was a really successful show. It's a great show. And I came off the stage, and I was in the dressing room getting changed, and this little dapper fellow, this really well dressed little fellow with a little moustache and glasses, came up to me, and he had a deep gravelly voice. And,
yeah.
And he said, you got to join the band. And I said, well, you know, I'd love to, but I'm under contract. I got a contract with this other band, and I've got a contractual obligation. And he said, you're out of that contract. You're in the band. And he walked off, and I'm like, who the hell is that? You know? Who the hell is that guy? And they said, oh, that's Ahmed Erdogan.
Say that again. What's his name?
It's Ahmet Erdogan.
Oh,
Ahmet Erdogan,
Ahmet,
the chairman of Atlantic Records.
So he got you out of the contract and plugged you
in. He got me out of that contract, and I was in the band, yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Hey, let me jump back to there's a guy you're in Florida, and the guy's making little white lines, and he tells you it's not addictive, and so you say fine and off you go. So what happened to that? Where did that little storyline take?
Well, I mean, it was like it was just like, well, it became something to do every once in a while. I mean, it wasn't like I never had that thing where I had the craving where I had to have it, and I started spending thousands of dollars doing it. It was like it would just sort of show up every once in a while, or somebody would say, you know, you want some, it wasn't that expensive, you know what I'm saying?
Right. So it wasn't really your thing.
I love that.
Because
the thing I really liked about cocaine was, if I was going to go and get messed up, if I was out drinking,
right?
If I was out drinking and I started to feel like a little bit woozy drunk, you know, like, you know,
right?
If I found some cocaine, that would straighten me up right away, and it would allow me to drink more.
Yeah. Well,
that's how I use it. I didn't have to have the cocaine, but you know,
but it was a nice adjunct to your drinking.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of a miracle drug if you want to, you know, be a alcoholic, actually, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. When of course Eric Clapton's famous song Cocaine, so you know that comes to mind. Where do you think along the way here things turned the corner from I don't know, say just being a heavy drinker into something that became more problematic for you?
Along with drinking and using drugs comes a thing called unmanageability. The unmanageability that happens is that, well, you know, some people, they go out and they get busted 3 or 4 times drunk driving.
Yeah.
Some people get arrested for beating up their girlfriends, this, that, and the other. Well,
yeah.
I got people pregnant.
Oh.
Somewhere along the line, people started to get pregnant.
How does that happen anyway? Never mind. I'm just kidding.
Well, first of all, you know, my wife was like a casual girlfriend, lived in Paris, and I'd go and see her. She'd see me when she came to New York. She got pregnant. I said, okay, well, I was like 30 years old. Okay, well, come over and we'll raise this kid. And so she came over, I married her, and she came over, and we started a family. We had another child. And unbeknownst to me, in between those two children, I got somebody else pregnant, and I didn't find out about that until 9 years later, and that came accompanied with a lawsuit.
Oh.
And then what did I do when that happened? Was that I got somebody else pregnant?
Oh.
And I had all these lawyers chasing me and a lot of stuff going on. And it was just like I was in this mess. I never thought, you know, and I was keeping a secret from my wife and. My ex-wife then, but,
and I was
responsible for my children, and they were under threat because of all, you know, people, you know, I work with a lot of big stars, you know,
yeah.
and a lot of big stars that have, make a lot of money.
Sure.
And I earn a really good living, but I don't make the kind of money that they make. But when people say, oh, he works with Duran Duran, he works with Eric Clapton, he works with the worked with Average White Band, it was a big band in those days. And,
sure, they see the dollar signs.
Yeah, they see the dollar signs, and they came after me like I was a billionaire. You know, and it was like, well, wait a minute, this isn't the fact. You know, this is not what's happening, and so I had a lot of financial problems that were, oh. You know, and the only way that I could deal with that stuff that was going on was to get drunk, and when I got drunk, I'd forget about it.
Right.
But sooner or later, as you do that, and when you come to, the problem's still there. It hasn't been solved, and it's maybe got a little bit bigger. And pretty soon what happened was that I couldn't get enough alcohol inside of me or drugs inside of me that I could hide from those problems anymore.
Yeah.
And so I knew some people that got sober. I knew a couple of people that had got sober, and they'd gone to Alcoholics Anonymous and stuff. And
mm-hmm.
That was, really wasn't that attractive to me, I didn't even think I was alcoholic. They were like worse drunks than I were. You know,
sure.
I was. You know, and I said, well, you know, I'm gonna stop. And I decided, You know, I was now 43 years old.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm gonna stop try life without any booze or drugs and see what happens with that, you know. And it was then that I found out that I was alcoholic.
Because you couldn't stop.
It wasn't that I couldn't stop. I stopped, but I started to detox.
Oh, okay.
And as I was detoxing, I was saying, well, what the hell is this? Yeah.
Well,
this shouldn't be happening to me. I'm waking up. I'm waking up in the middle of the night, covered in sweat. You know, thinking, having had a dream that I'd used, and I couldn't tell if the dream was real or not.
Uh-huh.
You know, every once in a while I go to rehabs. I go do service work, and I go to treatment centers, and I sit in these treatment centers, and I go there. To talk to people that are in there about recovery, and I sit there and I look at these people, and they look like somebody took a telephone book and smashed them as hard as they could in the face with a telephone book.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that's what I look like after 3 weeks. I guess that's what had happened to me.
you got hit by a telephone book.
I got hit by a truck, I think. I was really struggling. You know, it was really a struggle. It was really difficult, and it was giving me a whipping. You know, and it wanted my alcoholism wanted its drug and wanted its booze, and I wasn't giving it to it.
And it was beating you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a good friend of mine who lives in Austin, Texas, who'd been in recovery for 4 years, called me up and said to me, you know, hey, just called up to see how I was doing. And I told him, and he said, well, why don't you go and get some help, you know? And I said, well, I don't want to go do that. I don't want to get any help.
Yeah, that's for losers or something.
Yeah, yeah. And so he said, look, you know what? He says, I'm going to get on a plane, and I'm going to hop up there, hang up the phone. And I hung up the phone, and he booked a flight, and he just went and jumped on a plane and came to New York and took me to a place to get recovered, you know, took me to meet some people.
Took you to meet some people. Yeah.
Yeah, and I met these people, and just meeting them, I felt better. Yeah. You know? I have no idea how that worked.
Right.
The only reason that I went was out of the goodness of my heart, because this guy had come all the way from Austin to New York to try and help me. Yeah. You know?
Right. And so you
I felt better seeing him. You know, that was good enough, just seeing him.
Right.
And talking to him. And then he took me to this place, and there's all these people, and I spoke to these other people, and I listened to these people talk, and I felt better. So basically that's what sort of started me on my road to recovery.
And you still have contact with that person?
He passed away 2 years ago.
Oh.
He passed away of cancer 2 years ago, and I got to go with him. And his advisor, the guy who works with him, we got to go and see him in Texas, and
before
and
he passed
out.
Away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I got to go and travel to see him. So.
Well, that's good. I like the term his advisor. I get that. His advisor and you. Yeah, so it sounds like he was probably one of the most. Was he in the music business?
Yes, his name was Stephen Bruton.
Oh, okay. Okay.
He wrote all the music to Crazy Heart.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So
he's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful man, and I love him dearly.
Yeah, and so a couple other things. How do you maintain your clean, you know, your clean status? I mean, do you continue to keep in touch with these same or similar people? What do you do?
Yes, I stay in touch with groups of recovering alcoholics all over the world, and there's pretty good networks that go on and do, organize different organizations and stuff. You get to meet people, I stay in touch with them, and I go see them, and I call them up, and we talk, and sometimes meet people who barely speak any English, and I barely speak anything of what they're speaking, and I see the French people I get along with pretty good, because I speak French and I speak Italian pretty good, there's a language of recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Amongst people that everybody kind of understands, you know, that people just understand.
Yeah, that goes beyond the language.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. How do you think you handle problems differently today than you did?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And if I don't, I it's easy for me to say I don't know how to handle one now. At one point, I used to be able to handle everything. Yeah. I didn't want to tell anybody that if there was something that came up, I didn't want to tell anybody I don't know what to do. Now it becomes a lot easier to ask for help.
Yeah, that's So in other words, it's okay to have problems that you don't know how to handle.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a good thing. What's your take on giving back? Is that something that you do, and is that helpful to you? How does that work?
As often as I can.
Yeah.
You know, there's a number of people in this business, in my business, in the music business, because I travel a lot and I travel all over the world, and there's a lot of people that when they travel and do what I do, they always find some kind of a difficulty in getting to a meeting of alcoholics and.
Mm-hmm.
I always say to them, look, you never had a problem finding time to get to a bar, right? So why don't you just there is no excuse for that, you know.
Yeah.
It's like I go to bed late. You go to bed late, then get up early, set the alarm clock, get up early, make sure that you get there and get to a meeting, or pick up the phone and look for somebody, you know, talk to them on the phone.
Sure. Well, and you're a pretty bright light. So, you know, I mean, I would imagine that people that have that kind of problem or know that your status as a recovering person, that they would find you, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, you sort of get guided around. You know, I find myself sort of getting guided. But I walked into I went to my regular meeting that I go to here.
Yeah.
And then after I left that meeting, I was on my way to boxing, and on the way to boxing, there's another place where they have meetings. You know, where they have these meetings, and I decided, well, you know, I'm going to pop in it. Let me just pop in this meeting. And I walked in the meeting, and there was a guy in there that I knew for years who just got sober, you know.
Uh-huh.
He just stopped, and he does what I do.
Yeah.
He plays drums, and I saw this guy, and he was kind of shocked to see me in there, and I'm like, what are you doing here? And then they asked me to lead the meeting. so So I got to lead the meeting, and then we got to hang out a bit afterwards. And he's been in contact, and he's doing what I do, and it seems to be working for him too. But you know,
yeah.
I don't think you know. You ask me what I do,
yeah.
And I think that the answer is I don't say, well, I do this and I do that and I do. I can tell you what I do, right?
Yeah.
But I do anything, and the reason that I do anything is that I have to take myself by surprise sometimes. The reason that I say that is that you know, sometimes I'll be driving home, and I know where people meet, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I look at my watch and I say, oh, I'm going to go to that meeting, and I just go to it, you know,
right.
Because I got nothing else to do, and I can go there for an hour, and I go there for an hour, and I hang out with the people for an hour at that meeting, and I try to take things to the meeting, and I try to learn things from the meeting. Because you know, my alcoholism took me by surprise. You know?
Right.
And from what I see, it can take people by surprise, even with long-term sobriety.
Sure.
You know, if you see somebody relapse, and they've got like a year, or they got a year, it seems like a long time. If they've got like a year, it's not such a long time in terms of sobriety.
Right.
But if you see someone that's got like, you know, 6 months or a month or a couple of weeks or something, and they relapse, it's pretty ugly.
Yeah.
But if you see somebody that's had like long-term sobriety, 15, 16, 17, 20 years, 25
right.
years,
right.
30 years, if you see them relapse, oh my God, it's ugly.
It's ugly,
the ego gets affected.
Sure.
It's so hard to come back. And I've seen, it's not impossible to come back, but it is so hard. I don't want to do that.
So you have to, it sounds like you're saying, you know, there's not a perfect formula for what you do. You're telling that story about, you know, just stopping at the club and or the place, whatever, and running into this other drummer, you know, kind of on a whim. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's, You know, you hear the phrase, you know, there are no coincidences, you know, and that certainly would appear to be a coincidence, but then there you are, you know,
right.
And there you are, and you help this guy, and you know, so maybe it's not such a coincidence, but, and then the other thing you're saying is like, it almost sounds like you're saying you're taking your disease by surprise rather than letting it take you by surprise.
Absolutely. Proactive.
That's a pretty good way to look at it. I like that.
Yeah. I want to keep it on its toes. I don't want to keep, you know.
You don't want it to keep you on
its toes. It already keeps me on its toes.
I get you. Keep it guessing. That's really good. Let me ask you one more thing, and then we're probably going to have to wrap this up. But it's maybe a pretty big question, but, you know, I guess the question is, what have you learned about life from both the music business and then also, you know, learned about yourself, you know, since you've cleaned up, since you've gotten sober. What are some of the things that you've learned, some of the pieces of wisdom? Because, you know, you've been around a while, so I think people would be very interested to hear some of the pieces that you've gotten.
Well, I think, you know, one of the most important lessons that I've learned in 20 years is that you know, Tom Petty wrote a song once, and in that, he had a line in there that says, "Most things that I worry about never happen anyway." You know? and that's a real truth. Most things that I do worry about just don't happen.
Right.
And then there's the other side of it where something does happen, and instead of having to run to a bottle or to a drug because something's happening that I don't like, if I stop and wait, it usually opens up to something that I didn't expect, something
mm-hmm.
really wonderful that I didn't expect. So none of us have any control over it, even though I know probably there's some people out there that think they do have some control. But I got news for you. If you're listening, you don't have any control over anything. Life is good, and it's going to remain good. There's only seemingly bad things that happen, and there's seemingly wrong things that happen. You know, one of the child that was in the most contentious lawsuit, I have a relationship with today. And she's having going to have my fifth grandchild any day now. And she's having some issues. And she called me and she told me the issues that she was going through. And I said to her, you know, if you think back over the years and all the stuff that we've been through, you know, by rights, we shouldn't be talking now.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
By rights, you know, we shouldn't be having this conversation. But you know, we are. So you don't have to worry about what's going on now. It's going to be fine. My advisor always says to me, you know, things aren't going to be all right. They already are all right. You know? And you just have to wait and see what happens to it. And it's all going to be good. I mean, I have this relationship. You know, and I said, look who you're talking to. Yeah. This shouldn't be happening.
Yeah, the guy with whom we've had all these problems, and here it is.
Yeah.
She's calling you up for advice about her problems.
Absolutely. And not only that, but I managed, you know, I said, you know, there's a level that I have that I've had with this recovery, with my recovery, that I can actually be grateful to her mother being the way that she was, because if she hadn't have been that way, that tenacious, then I would have never had the need to stop drinking.
Yeah.
You know, I would never have got to that point.
Yeah.
So I'm truly grateful for the stuff that happened. The seemingly bad stuff that happened got me to this place that I am now, this place of comfort, I suppose you call it, that I would never have got to. I would never have realized a lot of things if I hadn't had that issue, that problem,
I now call an
opportunity for growth.
So more will be revealed, and if we wait long enough, what we thought was a problem will be an asset.
Yeah, and the problem will pass. You know,
it will pass.
You know,
in fact, it won't be a problem.
No, it won't be a problem. It'll be a blessing. You know. If you can just stick to it.
I think that that's absolutely fantastic advice and fantastic, a really inspiring thing to say and a story. And I just want to tell you that I appreciate your time and your willingness to join us on the show. And I think, you know, our focus is hope and recovery, and that's exactly what you've provided us. Thank you.
I appreciate it. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to do this with you, Rick. And if you hear of anybody, because I know you're around the business a lot there, and I know your wife works with a lot of people. If you ever need anybody to talk to somebody, please don't hesitate to give them my number.
An advisor?
Yeah, if they need an advisor, if they need somebody who can maybe steer them in a place where they can get some help.
Perfect. That's what we'll do. Steve, again, thank you, and I hope we'll get a chance to talk again soon.
Yeah, man, it was terrific. Thank you very much.
Thanks to tonight's guest, Steve Ferroni, and our show, The Rhythms of Life. Again, Steve, it was great spending time with you, and thank you to our listeners for making us a successful little underground support source for the recovering community. We'll email reminders for next week's show, and as always, try to look at things from a wide and open perspective. Remember to check recoveryinternetradio.com for all the archive shows and to sign up for our email reminder list. Remember, too, that we want to hear from you so we know where you are listening from. Because we are an internet radio show, we don't always know where you're from. So as always, live today, love yourself and your neighbor, and together we'll trudge the happy road to destiny. We hope you've enjoyed the show, and we'll see you at 8 o'clock next Sunday night.